The only ones that can understand this chapter are those that are disciples. He's explaining when the end of the world will be. They wanted to know when one of these events going to occur that's going to usher in the end of the world, and Jesus begins to explain to them in the 13th chapter. And again, he told us the first thing that we'll notice is there will be great deception. People will run around claiming they're Christians. More importantly, in the last 7 years, people will run around claiming they're the Antichrist, or that they're the Messiah, which we understand to be the Antichrist. And he says, don't be afraid of this. Another thing we'll know is that there will be lots of ethnic troubles, nation against nation, ethnic group against ethnic group. There will be countries fighting each other, kingdom against kingdom. There will be lots of earthquakes. There will be famines. There will be troubles. There will be wars. There will be rumors of wars. All these things will be going on, and we'll know the end is near. And of course, we're beginning to see these signs today. He explained also that once this thing kicks off, 3.5 years into it, there will be a sign called the Abomination of Desolation in the 14th verse. And he explained earlier, this chapter was first given by Jesus in Matthew 24. So we often go back to Matthew 24 to try and get our bearings, because Matthew gives two chapters and Mark only condenses it into one. And so we will be going back today to chapters 24 and 25 in Matthew. But he did say there would be a sign. You'd actually see it with your eyes. There would be an abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, when they would actually go into the temple itself and they would build an idol, a graven image, and set it up in the Jewish temple. And he says, when you see that, then begin to run, for that's the beginning of the great tribulation. That'll be the final 3.5 years. And he said the great tribulation will be days of tribulation and affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation which God created unto this time, and neither shall be. It'll be a terrible time of suffering. God will be pouring his wrath out upon planet Earth using his hand, bringing judgments upon the earth, not just using people as working the miracles. God himself will be working the miracles, throwing earthquakes and tornadoes and all kinds of events on planet Earth for a 3.5 year period. The amount of death will be astounding. I forgot, get our Revelation series from years ago. We did the calculations before. I've lost track in my mind. It's somewhere between 100 and 200,000 people a day God is killing continually for a 42-month period, just every day. I mean, just turn the news on, 200,000 people were killed today, 200,000 people were killed today, 200,000 people, just doing it continually for a 42-month period, as God is just purging the planet of sinners. It's not a bad idea. Here's the thing. And I'm not saying you should pay any attention. I sometimes pay attention. We have an election year coming up, and it is curious to watch how the various people running for office jockey for position to get the votes of the people voting for them. And in their desire to get a vote, they want to position themselves whereby the person voting is comfortable. So they want to do what's comfortable to the person voting. Okay, yeah, sure. The problem is, the reality is, like I figured out even long ago when I was a lost man back in the 1980s, and they wanted me to run for office. And I, even as a lost man, and I didn't know there was a God, I didn't know there was a heaven, didn't know there was a hell, didn't know there was a spirit world, but I knew there was truth. I knew 2 + 2 = 4. And I knew that the way they were running the government wasn't going to work. And I also knew that somebody had to get up and tell the people, this isn't going to work, folks. We need to fix this. And I also knew from my own private conversations that the voters didn't want to hear the truth. I was a lost man, but I knew that. I mean, I knew that. I knew. I said, if you get up and tell these people the truth, they won't vote for you. They want to be lied to. I didn't know anything about the sin nature. I knew nothing about a Bible, but I was smart enough from listening to people on the street. These people really want to be lied to. They really are, I guess they're that stupid or ignorant. I don't know what they are, but they like lies rather than truth. I mean, the thought that there can be a government that can give you welfare and give you Social Security and give you health care, are you really that dumb to believe that? Don't you know that stuff costs money? And don't you know someone's got to pay for that somewhere? And don't you know ultimately you're paying for it? And don't you know, ultimately, if you put the money to Washington before they give you whatever product they promised or service to give you, they first line their own pocket? So don't you realize you're not getting dollar for dollar? Have you not figured that out? Are you really that dumb? See, I knew that in my 20s and 30s as a lost man. So here's my point. Right now, everybody's trying to lie to liars and give liars what they want. And when the Lord comes back, he doesn't want a bunch of liars as his servants. So here's what he's doing. He's picking people right now that want truth. And when he comes back, rather than asking for the liars to vote for him, he's going to kill them all. How's that? That's what he's doing. That's what the tribulation's about. He's going to kill all the voting sinners out there and leave a world only with those that like truth.
Yeah.
See, that's what the tribulation's about. He's not coming back to be voted for by the voters. He's going to kill the voters. Just a thought to consider. Don't you love the book? Jesus said, I am the truth. So I'm not coming back to jockey myself for a bunch of sinning liars, adulterers and adulteresses. What a great deal. So that's what the tribulation's about. So he's coming back and he's warning people. And he's saying, look, if I was you, I'd get out of this thing. But if you want to stick around for it, be my guest and you can get wiped out too. Here, let me give you a verse from the Old Testament. Let me find it for you. You'll enjoy it. Stuff you can only find if you're willing to open a Bible. Let me see where it is for you. It's one of the minor prophets. You'll enjoy this. Go to the book of Micah, chapter 5. Here's what he's doing. People are funny. They like lies. Yeah, we got a welfare program for you. We got Social Security for you. We got health care for you. Sure you do. Yeah. It's too expensive to buy it on your own. Give us the money first and we'll take care of it for you. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Does that make sense to you? You can't afford a car, so give us the money. We'll get you a car. You say, where's the first portion of the money going? What kind of a car am I going to end up with? They show you a Lexus, you're going to get a broken down, rusted old Yugo. That's going to be your health care system. Anyways, whatever makes you happy. You're going to get free health care. If you think health care is expensive now, wait till you see what it costs when it's free. Yeah. Wait till you see what you're getting. But nonetheless, it's another story. Micah chapter 5, here's what the Lord's going to do in the tribulation. Micah chapter 5, verse 11. The Lord speaking, verse 10, and come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, I'll cut off thy horses out of the midst of thee. I'll destroy thy chariots, those are the armies. I will cut off the cities of thy land. I will throw down the strongholds. I will cut off the witchcrafts out of thy hand, the 1-900 numbers, and thou shalt have no more soothsayers. Thy graven images also will I cut off, thy standing images out of the midst of thee, implied, I'll cut them off. Thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands, and I will pluck up thy groves out of the midst of thee. So will I destroy thy cities, and I, the Lord, verse 10, will execute vengeance in anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. That's the tribulation. So back to where we were in Mark 13. We don't have to do a thing. It's a great thing. I don't have to hurt anybody. My bark is worse than my bite. I have no bite. I'm just warning you, if you don't get right, he's coming back. Step aside and let him deal with it. Mark 13. So he's warning his men, look, be prepared, and when you see the abomination of desolation, get out of town, because I'm coming back to do damage. Go and hide. Now, so we've been working our way through here. We've studied a lot of this. You can go back and listen to our studies from the past few weeks on Mark 13. He explained that the elect were the Jews. We looked at that. After the tribulation, he's going to turn the lights out, verse 24. In those days after the tribulation, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars of heaven shall fall. That's figurative. That's allegorical language. No, it's literal. No, he's going to turn out the lights on planet Earth. There will be darkness. The world will be plunging darkness. Well, we'll turn on our electrical lamps. You won't have any electricity. He'll have ripped the infrastructure of the planet apart. All the power lines will have fallen down like Godzilla and King Kong have hit them. There will be no power. There will be nothing. They will be plunged in darkness. And then the Lord will come back. We learned last week the fig tree was the key for us to understand in verse 28. The parable of the fig tree. When her branch is tender and she puts forth her leaves, you know that summer is near. And we saw last week the fig tree, which was spoken of in Matthew 24, which was explained for us in Jeremiah 24, was the nation Israel. And we added 24 plus 24, which is 48. And in 1948, the nation Israel came back. And so the Lord said, when you see the nation Israel reborn, it's coming near. He said, this generation will not pass. We studied last week that a generation is two things. It has to do with generating a seed, a race of people, a birthing of people to generate. And so the fig tree comes back and begins a generation. And it also has to do, in addition to people, it has to do with time. So it's a dual reference. And we saw the timeline given by God in the last testament was the timeline of the generation of judgment would be the two times before when he judged people. One was at the time of Noah when he judged the world, and the other was at the time of bringing his people out, the generation out of Egypt, and bringing them into the land. So bringing his people in the land, and the generation time he used then, he said it would be four generations. And we did the mathematics from Genesis 15, and it lined up with the same one from the judging of the world in Genesis 6. It's 120 years. So the generation is 120 years of judgment. And it makes sense. This is a dual judgment. He's going to, number one, be judging the heathen like we saw, like he did in Genesis 6, and he's going to be bringing his people in the land. So it's the same thing. And so it's 120 years. So from 1948 until 2068, that's all the time God has. You can bet every dollar you have and everything that everybody you know has on a sure bet that Jesus Christ will be back on this planet, and his throne will be in Jerusalem, and he will be running this planet no later than 2068. End of story. Or this book is not worth reading, I would say fold it up and go do something else today. That's what I would say. I wouldn't play with religion. It's not worth it. Life is short. Let's eat, drink, and be merry. But every other prophecy he's given has come to pass. We've studied this before, and so this will come to pass. By 2068, you can bet everything everybody has ever had that Jesus Christ will be sitting on that throne in Jerusalem. That's the outside year, according to his own words. Now, it's going to be shorter than that, because we saw last week how he cut the judgment short, and he even said right here in one of these verses, verse 20, and except the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh should be saved. And with the way things are going now, if he waited to 2068, we might destroy ourselves in a nuclear holocaust. Because we are getting a little crazy with the nuclear weapons. And I do not know that actually that we could destroy the planet with nuclear weapons. I do not know that we have enough firepower to do that. But we probably do have enough firepower to extinguish human life with the nuclear weapons. They're very potent. The small ones are called fission bombs, and they're measured in kilotons of energy. Kilo is 1,000, ton, they're referring to a ton of dynamite. So I don't know if your kids have ever played with an M80. When you were young, M80s were like the biggest firecrackers you could get. They were real fun ones. That's a quarter stick of dynamite. So four M80s is one stick of dynamite. So a ton of dynamite, one ton. A kiloton would be 1,000 tons. So 1,000 tons. And the one that hit Hiroshima, the smallest bomb we ever blew up, was 13 kilotons. So that'd be 13,000 tons of dynamite. And a ton is 2,000 pounds. So 13,000 times 2,000, that'd be 26 million pounds of dynamite. That's the smallest bomb we have. 26 million pounds of dynamite. That's the smallest atomic bomb we have. That's called a fission bomb. Then we have bigger bombs. They're called fusion bombs. And for those, the fission bomb is the detonator. You detonate the fusion bomb with a fission explosion. So you put a little boy, that's what the Hiroshima bomb is, inside the fusion to start the fusion reaction. And the fission splits the atom, but the fusion fuses the atoms, and that's a hydrogen bomb. And those are measured in megatons. And mega is a million tons. which would be billion pounds of dynamite. So those the H-bombs that we've exploded, the biggest one ever exploded, I can't remember, was 50 megatons. So that's just, that's inconceivable, the amount of damage. So we probably do have enough with the bombs that we're working on to do that. Now, just for your own sake, and to give you, to edify you a little bit about what's going on, and the Iranians are building bombs, and the Pakistanians are, yeah, sure they are. And they are, and I understand. And the North Koreans are building bombs, yeah, they are. And they're pitiful, piss-poor bombs. I saw the one that they exploded in North Korea. I'm not even convinced it was a nuclear weapon. I think it was just a lot of dynamite taped together, because I saw the fallout from it. It was okay, but it was nothing like a true nuclear weapon. And the bombs these people are working on are basically just fission bombs. But they're not the issue. The problem is, if they do get these weapons, they're likely to start a chain reaction of weapons. That's the problem. They really, in truth, when you see the very crude work that these North Koreans and these Iranians, it's very funny to watch the stuff they do, to watch the crude technology. I mean, even if they got the bomb, what are they going to do, ride it over on a bicycle? I mean, they have no way of delivering the thing, I don't know, maybe they'll deliver it a parcel post or something, and you got to sign for it when the bomb arrives and pay the shipping charges. I don't know, but once the bomb gets there, they have a great difficulty getting it, and even if they do, they're not sure it's going to go out, because a nuclear weapon requires weapons-grade fissionable material, and you need like 99% fissionable pure material for it to work, or it does. It won't get a chain reaction going. So it's not as simple as you think. And this, don't be frightened by people talk about a suitcase bomb. There is no such thing called a suitcase bomb. That's science fiction. You couldn't have a bomb, a fissionable bomb, small enough to fit in a suitcase. It's not doable. It is not doable. You need a minimum of about 150 pounds of fissionable material to conduct a good explosion. So, I mean, that was the smallest one we ever did. It was called Little Boy, and it was 150 pounds of material. So I don't know of many 150-pound suitcases. And even if you've got the 150 pounds of material, you still need the packaging and the detonating material around it, the trigger. So there is no such thing called a suitcase bomb. When they talk about a suitcase bomb, they're just confusing you, because they know you don't know any better. And all they're talking about is this, is if somebody did get a suitcase full of dynamite and put some radioactive material in it, the thought is, if you blow it up, you're spreading radiation. And that's possible, but big deal. Oh, I'm really scared. I mean, it's not a big deal at all, so don't be afraid of that stuff. They're doing very crude work, these folks over there, these Arabs. But they're trying to steal our technology, and they're not being very successful. But even if they did, in the next 10 or 20 years, and they get a hold of these one or two fissionable bombs, and even if they drive in a car, you know, a Yugo or a Chevy, want the bomb over to Israel and blow it up, which they're known to do, they'll drive cars and blow things up, it's liable to start a chain reaction, because Israel does have bombs. Israel does have technology. The Israelis are not dumb. They're the smartest people on planet Earth. They're 50% of all the Nobel laureates in the last century. They're less than 1% of the population of planet Earth. They're geniuses. And they have great technology. They have fission, and they have fusion bombs, and they have the ability to deliver it. And it would probably start a series of reactions going back and forth that would be insane. So Jesus says, except I shorten the days, no flesh would be saved. And so he's not going to take till 2068. That's my only point. Okay, going down. So we've learned a lot of things. And then he just wants you to understand that, verse 30, verily, truly, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be done. When the fig tree comes back, I guarantee you, you've got 120 years, and I'm going to wrap this thing up, and it is going to be all finished. And the present evil world, as you know it, will end, and the Son of Man will come on clouds of glory and usher in his kingdom, and you can just bank on it. Verse 31, well, am I sure of that? Well, verse 31, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. And the only thing you can trust on this planet is that book that's in your lap. That's the only physical thing that you can count on. Everything else on this planet, God intends to destroy one day. The only things that will be saved on this planet are the words of God's book and the souls that are wrapped in God's Spirit. And everything else, he's going to shake the heavens and the earth, and everything will be removed, and the only thing that can't be removed are those things that he has his hand and his Spirit on, and that would be saved people and his words. The voice that shook the earth now speaks. He promised, yet once more, I shake, not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word, once more, signifying the removing of those things that are shaken and the things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. And the only things that won't be shaken are the souls wrapped in his Spirit and that book. And you can bank on it. Now, verse 32, he says, but of that day and that hour, which day and that hour? That is the day when the Son of Man returns. When you see the Son of Man coming in great power and setting up his kingdom. Verse 26, and then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And this is what everyone's waiting for, is the return of Jesus Christ.
Amen.
He came the first time, and the only hope we have is when he comes back the second time. We are hopeless. This planet is hopeless. This nation is hopeless. It's just, there's no hope. Again, I watch every so often. Yesterday, I'm preparing and I'm listening to C-SPAN. Does anybody ever watch C-SPAN? Do you know what that is? Okay. C-SPAN is a camera that they have inside the congressional building, and you can watch Congress at work. And so you can watch them as they're working, as they're drafting legislation. So I watch every so often just to see. And I listen as they go back and forth. And there are a few honest people trying to do right. They really are. They're not many. There's about 7 or 8 or 9 of them. And they get up and they try and say things to their members like, this isn't going to work. We're going to kill everybody here. We're all going to go bankrupt. This thing is going to fall apart. Please, we've got to do something. You see these poor guys pleading. And then you see all the other liars, you know. It's interesting to watch. But as you watch this stuff, I mean, you realize it's over. They know it's over. One of them was showing a graph showing that we are in such a bind now financially that we have to pay the interest on all our past debt. Got to pay that. So the minute we collect money in taxes, the first thing that we pay is the interest. Okay, so we do that. And then we have what's called fixed obligations, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. And then we finally have discretionary spending, and that's everything else. That includes the Army. That includes the Department of Education. That includes all these other things as discretionary spending. And they showed right now we're in such a bind that if you took all the money we collected, we can pay the interest, we can pay only part of the fixed spending, and we have nothing left. If we close the entire federal government down, he said, shut it down, we'd still be in debt. If we shut it down, if we fired every federal employee and sent them home, and shut the government down totally, and still took all our tax money, we have enough to pay interest, just to pay part of our fixed spending, and we still can't do any discretionary spending. That's how bad we are. We're finished. And he said, please, let's do something. And you watch these guys trying. Look, we're without hope. It's over. So what do we have? We need the Son of Man to come back. He's the only one that can fix the mess that we're in. These men don't have the few men that have the knowledge to do it. Let's say a guy like a Paul Ryan, who's actually worked on it, this poor young man, and you watch how he's tarred and feathered for even trying to tell the truth. Please, folks, we're going off a cliff, and then they want to kill this guy. The poor few guys that want to do it, there's nobody behind them, and there's not the will behind the rest of the people to get it done. There's no hope. We need the Son of Man to return. So the day and the hour that the Son of Man comes back, verse 32, of that day and that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Now, right here, he's talking about the return of Jesus Christ. He's not talking about the rapture. Do you understand that? The rapture has occurred 7 years ago, according to what he's talking about here. We're studying the time of Jacob's trouble. We're studying the tribulation. We're studying the time of the Jews and the elect, like he told us in a number of verses, This deals with his elect nation, Israel, Isaiah 45. Go back and listen to our study. So this is not for the church. The church had been gone for 7 years. But he's talking, these Jews that are hiding out in the great tribulation and waiting, and when are you coming? When are you going to get back? If you don't get back, we don't have any hope. If you don't get back, no flesh. We're all going to die. We need you to get back. Nobody knows the day and the hour when the Son of Man will return. Not even the Son at the time he's speaking the words. Okay, these words are recorded while he's sitting on the Mount of Olives talking. At that time, as the Son, right there, he did not know. And I have a feeling he knows now. It would seem to me now, sitting next to the right hand of the Father, he knows. Maybe perhaps his Father's not telling him, but I find that hard to believe right now, sitting up there. But at that time right there, he did not know either. He did not need to know while he was 33 years old. He's the week before he's, this is the week he's going to go to the cross. It's on Tuesday here. He's going to the cross in 2 days. He doesn't know at that time. And the only point is, prophecy. This is one of the things he may be trying to teach us. When it comes to prophecy, there are things that are through a glass darkly that we don't know. So there's no need to fight over it. There's no need to argue over it. There's no need to say, well, I need to know this. You don't need to know this. What you need to do, verse 33, is take ye heed. Watch and pray. For you know not when the time is. So let me give you some practical advice. You don't need to know this information. All you need to know is there's a day I'm coming back. You can bank on it. You'll know that I'll be coming back after the tribulation. But you won't know, notice what he said, the day and the hour. He didn't say the times or the seasons. We do know the times or the seasons. This is the time of Jacob's trouble. This is the season of God's discontent of winter as he's pouring out his wrath. We know that. We just don't know the particular day or the hour. These people are going to have to live by faith. That's what he wants to teach them to. You're going to live day by day by faith, the people in the trib. Now, good practical advice for us. We can live day by day by faith. There's a day and hour you and I don't know. That's the day and hour when we meet the Son of Man at our death. Because you and I know when we die, we meet the Son of Man. I mean, to be absent and in the body right now, we're absent from the Lord. But the minute we die, we are present with the Lord. So that day and hour, I don't know when it is. It could happen in my life anytime. So what do I want to do? Practically, take heed, watch, and pray. Live almost as though you're in the tribulation. We are in the tribulation of this life. We are in the tribulation of living at a time where our King is not on the throne. We're at a time now where, for the most part, the world is against us, just like they're going to be against the elect at that time. So how do we live? We live by faith. And that's how God wants us to live. Verse 34, for the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work. And he commanded the porter to watch. Watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh. I mean, I don't know when my time is going to end for serving my Lord, and he has given me authority as a servant. He has given me as a man work to do. He's given me as a porter something to watch over, and I don't know when he's going to end my shift. That's in his hands. So what should I be doing? I should be watching. I don't know when he's going to come, at even, at midnight, at the cockcrow, in the morning. I don't know when he's going to come for me. I mean, I know not what a day may bring forth. I'm speaking to you right now at 10:40 in the morning. I don't know if I'll be here 10:40 tonight. I don't know that. You don't know that. So how should I live today? Watchfully, prayerfully, trusting, and being about the duty that God's given me. He's asked me to have a watch. He told me to watch. What does that mean? Go to Ezekiel chapter 3. Practically in our lives. Verse 17 in Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 17. Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. Okay, so you and I, we're watchmen that God's made. Under the house of Israel, particularly for me, this is one of the two chapters where God really laid his hand on me. If I had a chapters where God called me for my work in the mid-90s, it would be Ezekiel 2 and 3. There's no doubt about it. Those are the chapters where God was all over me. I remember walking around and being troubled in my kitchen and not understanding what was going on. And those definitely are the chapters he called me. I'm a watchman unto the house of Israel. I'm a watchman unto the Church of Jesus Christ. You and I are, we're watchmen to what God's given us, whatever part of the house that God's given us to be in. What do we need to do? We need to hear the word at God's mouth. That's the first thing we can do. The first thing we need is to listen. We'll talk about that in the next service. And then what do? Then we need to give warning. We need to hear, and then we need to speak. Verse 18, here it is. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and that's what God says, okay? The wages of sin is death. Wicked people surely will die. I mean, we're certain about that, are we not? Everybody dies. I mean, it's just the history of mankind. People die all the time. And so we understand that. And what happens to the wicked? Thou shalt surely die. And thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to turn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life. What are we supposed to do? We take a wicked man? We're supposed to say, listen, wicked man, listen, fellow, whatever, co-worker of mine, do you realize that you and I, by our very nature, we've done wicked things that are contrary to the law of God, and we have sin. And the sin is going to kill us. And not only our body, we're going to face the death of our soul. So we're supposed to warn that wicked man to turn from his wicked ways and to turn to God and repent. We have work to do to turn people to God, and to turn them from the way that seems right unto them, which is the way of death. We're supposed to do that. If we don't warn him, verse 18, when I say to the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man, he shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. I'm going to hold you accountable, because you knew the truth and he didn't. And one day he'll stand in judgment, and his ignorance is no excuse. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, right? We all know that. I mean, the other day I drove by that I didn't, honest to goodness, I didn't know. I'm driving down this road, and the speed limit is like 50 miles an hour. But there was like a 400-yard patch where the speed limit was 25. And I didn't know. I drove right on by like an idiot. I had my thing on cruise control, right on by. Now, the reason was there was a school over there. Just, it was a driveway led to a school off to the side there. I'm paying no attention, I'm just driving along. I was ignorant of the change in speed for that patch of road. And I'm not paying attention. I'm not paying attention. I don't know. I'm listening to a tape. I'm driving. I got my cruise control. I zip right on by the area that's 25 for 400 yards. Ignorance is no excuse of the law. Policeman not pleased. Well, I didn't know there was a school. There's a school there. I was on cruise control. I was doing, it's 50 over there and 50 over there, but it's 25 over here. Ignorance is no excuse. And it's the same with God. If I don't warn this man, he's going to die. And now God's going to say, but you didn't tell him. And you had opportunity. We're watchmen. Watch, I tell you. Verse 19, yet if thou warn the wicked, and here's what we do, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. At least the blood's not on our hands anymore. See, what the Lord is teaching his disciples here, and we're going to go back, I'm going to show you who he's particularly speaking to in a doctrinal manner, but practically these things apply to us in a practical manner. He's telling us, look, we need to watch. We need to be faithful. We need to watch and pray. What are we watching for? Well, we're watching for the Son of Man, but we're also watching out for those around us. Just like a parent watches out for someone that's a child that can't take care of self, or even more particularly, like you as a responsible citizen would watch out for a blind man. If you were standing at a corner and somebody was blind and in their ignorance they started to walk out into traffic, would you not pull them back? Well, that's how these folks are. They're blind. And they're depending on us. And the Lord has made us a watchman to tell them. That's what our job is. What does he say in the one place there? I just want to see if I can find it for you in Corinthians. Here, go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We're watchmen. Practically. Now I'll show you in the trib, doctrinally, who those watchmen are. But right now, these people live a time of trial and tribulation in their life, and they live in darkness. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Paul is talking about how the god of this world blinds people so they don't believe. Verse 4, the god of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, like those blind men standing on the corner. And he blinds them, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. He says, so we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord. That's our job. We're watchmen. We're supposed to be preaching Jesus Christ the Lord to people. Verse 13, we, having the same spirit of faith, according as it is written, I believed, Son of Man, hear the words at my mouth, and then give them warning. And therefore have I spoken. We also believe, and therefore speak. And so, if anybody ever says to you, well, I believe faith is a personal thing, it's a quiet thing just to be exercised in your home, it's not something you should talk about, then it's not the faith of the Bible. Biblical faith is a broadcast faith. It's meant to be preached. It's meant to be spoken about. It's meant to be communicated so people can have communion with God through communication. That's the kind of faith we have. We need to watch who's out there that doesn't know the truth, and then pray, Lord, I want to get the truth to him, and then speak the truth to them and warn that wicked man so he has an opportunity to turn from his way. Now, I know many of them aren't going to turn, but that's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is merely to speak. So when everybody says, you know, I believe faith is a private thing, you can write verse 4:13, biblical faith is not a private matter. You can show them that verse, 2 Corinthians 4:13. Biblical faith is not a private matter. Maybe some other false faith is, but not the faith of Jesus Christ in the Bible. So practically, watch ye therefore. You don't know when he's coming. Now again, doctrinally, getting right back to the prophetic issue. He's telling those people. Now, I could just imagine if you were one of those Jews. Let's say you were one of those Jews, and the trumpet sounds and the Christians disappear, and there's a massive change going on planet Earth, and there's this guy signing a covenant with Israel, and they finally take the Muslims and wipe the dome off the rock, and they start rebuilding the temple, and then you're a Jew, and you start reading a Bible and putting two to two together and going, my goodness, look at this. This was all prophesied in the book. This guy is not the Messiah. Everybody says he is. He's the Antichrist. And then you have the faith of Jesus Christ, and now you're running and you're hiding. You've seen the abomination, desolation, and you're waiting, and you're waiting for the Lord to come back. And then you have your calendar, and you go back on your calendar and go, okay, when the heck was it when them people disappeared? And again, the calendar dates are so different. You know that. I mean, ours is 2012, Anno Domini, Year of the Lord. The Jews, I looked this morning, it's 5,772. Okay, their date, their calendar is different than ours because they date their calendar from the time that their rabbis could figure when Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden. And the best the rabbis can retrospectively work chronologically, Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden 5,772 years ago this fall. Fall, because they base it on the fall. That's when they think Adam was placed in the garden, which makes sense because Adam did fall. And then God changed their calendar and gave them a new calendar, and so they celebrate the civil year of Rosh Hashanah beginning in the fall, and God said, no, this is the first of the month to you, first month of the year. It's now in the spring. It's a picture of their new birth, because now life comes forth. The first birth, Adam, death, the new birth, Passover, under the blood, life, you know, so it's a different thing. But their calendar is so different, and they're probably looking at their calendar figuring, okay, if those people went up 6 years ago, well then, according to this, we know this is a seven-year tribulation, Daniel's week, and they're trying to figure the day and the hour, and he's saying, look, you're not going to know the day and the hour. I'm going to keep you walking by faith on a daily basis. And that's for the Jews at that time period. But you and I, we need to be walking by faith. We need to watch. We don't know when the master of the house is going to take us from this earthly tabernacle we're in. Verse 36, lest coming suddenly, he find you sleeping. And he doesn't mean in your bed, you know, waiting to get up the next day to go to work. He means spiritually asleep at the wheel. Okay? Awake to righteousness, Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. He was upset with them because, in the very verse where he said that, I'll find it for you, awake to righteousness and sin not. This is 1 Corinthians 15:34. Why? For some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. He's saying, you guys, here you are sleeping. You're surrounded by lost people. You're surrounded by blind people. You're surrounded by wicked people, and you haven't warned any of them. And I speak this to your shame. And I'm saying, awake to righteousness. Don't let me come back, the Lord say, personally in your life, and find you asleep. Where I can now take a list of all the people you know. And we can go and find out 80% of those people don't know that you're a born-again Christian that loves the Lord and have never heard the faith that you trust. Wouldn't that be awful? So this is practically, but doctrinally, he's talking to those men. But anyways, I just want to finish practically real quick, and then I'll take you to the doctrinal in a minute. So, watch ye therefore. Watch and pray, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. We don't want to find us practically sleeping. And what I say unto you, I say unto all. And then we know it spreads out to us. Watch. The idea of watchfulness is essential for us. We need to be watchful. Now, doctrinally, who's he talking to? In order to understand doctrinally, got to go back to the first Olivet Discourse and go back to Matthew chapter 25. And here's who he's talking to doctrinally. And people will be reading these chapters in the tribulation, to whom it's directed personally and doctrinally to them, just as much as Romans 3 is directed to you doctrinally and Romans 12 is directed to you doctrinally. They'll be reading that knowing this is no practical, this is no spiritual prophetical teaching. This is us. Matthew 25, verse 1. Then shall the kingdom of heaven, so again, we know it's Jewish again. It's not the kingdom of God. We're looking at the kingdom of heaven, getting setting up his kingdom, purging tribulation, getting ready. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were wise, and 5 were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight there was a cry made, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said unto the wise, give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. But the wise answered, saying, not so, lest there be not enough for us and you. But go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. Afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, verily, I say unto you, I know you not. And then he gives the warning again, so watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour when the Son of Man cometh. Who is he speaking to? Okay, he's talking to the virgins. The virgins are represented, go to Revelation chapter 14. I have to go to a few places here. Here we are in the tribulation. We're getting toward the end of the tribulation. And in Revelation 14, it says in verse 1, I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as of the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled for women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no guile. Ah, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile, Jesus said to Nathanael. Who are the 144,000? They were the same ones that were chosen in the seventh chapter, the ones that were chosen and sealed. There are 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Back in the seventh chapter, and he tells you there's 12,000 from Judah, 12,000 from Reuben. Who are they? These are the ones that God has raised up. These are his true prophets of the tribulation. These are his true watchmen that are out there preaching on the streets, preaching to the people. This is the end, folks. You know how you see crazy people today, the end is near, the end is near. Nutty Gentiles with signs in New York City and San Francisco that know nothing of the Bible. They're just kook. You know, with Nostradamus, and I don't know what's on their mind. No, the end isn't near. We're still in the age of grace. But the end of the age of grace is near. But these prophets are going to be out there, and the end is near. This is the time of trouble and doom and God bringing an end to mankind, finishing off his wrath once and for all. And they'll be out there preaching. Now, sadly, back in Matthew 25, there was a key verse in the 11th verse. Phrase. Afterward came the other virgins saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. That ought to key you right back to Matthew 7. There are three discourses he gives. He's going to connect the first and the third discourse. Matthew 7. Beware of deception. There will be many false prophets and false Christs at that time. Matthew 7, verse 15. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Verse 20. Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them. Verse 21. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, 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 open to us, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth of the will of my Father which is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, here we go, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name have done many wonderful works? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. So, who are the wise virgins? The wise virgins are the 144,000. Who are the foolish virgins? These guys that run around and use the name of Jesus Christ, even do miracles in his name. The other day I'm preparing and I got the TV on and I'm watching Kenneth Copeland. Yesterday I saw another guy on. Look at folks, you better watch out for miracles and visions, especially by Gentiles. I mean, for goodness sake, you ought to know no Gentile is getting visions or doing miracles. Do you understand that? That was for Jews. I mean, you smart enough as a Bible-believing, Bible-reading Christian, the minute a guy gets on television talking about he had a vision, he had a sign, he had a wonder, he had a miracle, you just turn him off. I don't care if the thing came to pass. He's a Gentile. End of story. There's only one person working through him. That's the devil, not God. Why? The Jews require a sign. The Greeks, the Gentiles, seek after wisdom, knowledge. Where do we get it? Right here in this book. That the man of God may be perfect, truly furnished. Everything is here for us. Only an evil and an adulterous generation would seek after a sign. You're not part of that generation, I hope. Sadly, at that time, talk about having discernment. You're going to really need discernment then. Because there's going to be Jewish men, false prophets, running around doing signs and miracles. The only way you're going to know the difference is if you have oil in your vessel, if you have the Spirit in you. You're going to really need spiritual discernment. God will give it. We're not going to be here. But I just wanted to show you doctrinally what's going on. Prophetically. Go back to Mark 13. And then one other thing about this passage in Matthew 7. For the poor Christian who gets beaten up sometimes. Some people mistakenly take this passage here in Matthew 7. Not everyone say, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom. And they apply it to people sitting in pews to make you doubt your salvation. It's got nothing to do with you. It's got to do with false prophets. Okay? If you, as a humble believer, have ever come to the Lord Jesus Christ, and confessed him as your Lord and received him in your heart, you're saved. He's talking about false prophets. If the shoe don't fit, don't wear it and don't try and slip it on someone. That's what he's talking about, false prophets. So unless you're guilty of going out being a false prophet, then you better be scared of that passage. But if you're just some humble, simple believer somewhere, don't let someone try and throw that net of this passage over you and snare you with it. It has nothing to do with you. It's a tragedy to see this book abused. Back to Mark chapter 13. So what do we learn practically? Practically, our job is to watch. Our job is to watch. Watch ye therefore. Take heed, verse 33. Watch and pray. And that's what we need to do. Why? There's a day coming. I don't know when it is. And the trumpet's going to sound, we're going to go up. More likely, looking at this crowd here, most of you aren't going to make it. We're not going to make it. Lord's going to get us before then. We don't know when he's coming. We don't know if he's coming in the morning. We don't come in the evening. I don't know when he's going to take our breath from us. We're going to meet him. I don't want to be one. I'm sure you don't want to be one. That when he comes, he finds us spiritually asleep. That if he measures the last week of our life, he'll say, for most of that week, you were asleep at the wheel. You didn't watch for anyone. You didn't pray for anyone. You didn't try and leave a good word with anyone. You didn't let your light show for anyone in a week. That would be awful, wouldn't it? So why don't we watch, therefore, and pray. Father, thank you for showing us doctrinally a time of Jacob's trouble that we need not go to. But Lord, as our Jacobs we are today, we got our enough troubles of our own. And we are watchmen. So Lord, help us to watch and help us to pray and help us not to be asleep. Help us to have our lights shining. So when the time does return and you come to get us, Lord, you'll be able to look at the past week and say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. This I pray in Jesus' name, amen.